I wasn't really daytime friends with anybody. Kareem Bunton. Stuart was always trouble. He was druggy before he got money, and then it just got worse and worse.
Jenny Eliskew. You knew some people were going to hate Stuart, or hate Jonathan Fire Eater because Stuart was so obviously a junkie.
Walter Martin. I think the first time I laid eyes on him after I came back to New York from Colorado, I knew. Even then, he looked different. Stuart Lupton. I grew tired of the banter and drinking 40s on the East Village AstroTurf and deviated into hard drugs.
Aaron Norris. He had every bit of promise, you know? And then very quickly he took advantage of the dark side that New York had to offer.
Stuart Lupton. That was back when walking out the door you'd see the dealers. It was just a different time where everyone did everything. $10 bought you a whole day of Nirvana.
Aaron Norris. He would do insane shit. Like, I'd say, pretty please, no drugs today. And I'd come back to the apartment and he'd be sitting on the couch with a wax schmear on the side of his fucking face from the back of the cook spoon. I had cats at the time, and when Stuart would stay over, they would piss in his suitcase because it smelled like a place you should piss in, you know? He brought the odor.
Stuart Lupton. I started getting arrested a lot for possession.
Aaron Norris. We were in the drug thing together. I got yelled at a little bit by Walter for enabling Stuart. Yes, I was enabling, but it was easy to be enabling. And for the most part, I was footing the bill. My rent was $550 a month, and I was making $90,000 a year. I have nothing to show for it. I should have, like, 3 houses. I did a lot of drugs, and I bought a lot of drugs for friends.
Stuart Lupton. I wasn't the only one in a band doing heroin, but I was the only one in my band that did it. They resented the fuck out of me for it. They still do. Walter Martin. We definitely wrote a lot of instrumental material because he wasn't at practice. Carl Swanson. Not long after they put out that first self-titled EP, a scout from Geffen started circling. Mark Spitz. There was money in the industry. You would go to the after party, and there would be live lobsters in a tank that starving rock writers like me would shove in our pants. Jason Gordon. Every 19-year-old intern at a record label had a corporate card.
Jenny Eliskew. It was still the era of major labels spending a lot of money on indie because of Nirvana. This Jonathan Fire Eater thing had buzz. It wasn't surprising that there was a lot of label interest in them.
Walter Martin. The major label stuff happened really quickly. Geffen Records flew us out to L.A. to see their offices and whatnot. We couldn't believe it. Walter Durkax. Basically, there wasn't a lot going on at the time, and people started being very curious about them. The industry and the press started to come around. Seymour Stein from Sire was very interested. Bob Krasnow, who signed Metallica, was very interested. Mark Spitz. Soundgarden had broken up. Oasis had not delivered on their potential. Blur weren't even sounding Britpop anymore. They were sounding like Pavement. There was always going to be Dave Matthews' band. You can't even criticize them. They're just there. It'd be like criticizing pigeons. You can't get rid of them. You just hope they don't shit on you. But the bottom line is there was money, and we needed new rock stars.
Aaron Norris. There was a huge, huge bidding war, and at the time, bidding wars were what press wanted to write about. But I think it actually hurt the band. It was always about the music, but then it became about the personality.
Walter Durkax. They were an A&R person's worst nightmare. Walter Martin. I didn't necessarily think it was that cool that we were being courted by all these labels. It was never like, pinch me. It was more like, this is so ridiculous. Walter Durkax. The band was really stubborn. They had this kind of, like, I don't care attitude. They didn't want to do it. It had to be pure. It had to be them playing their music on vintage instruments. They didn't want to do videos. Walter Martin. We didn't want to be in certain publications. We didn't want to have our pictures taken in certain ways. Stuart Lupton. We drew out the bidding war as long as we possibly could because we were broke, and they would take us out to these epic dinners. I don't even remember the names of some of these restaurants, and I'll never eat there again. We went to, you know, Balthazar with Warner Brothers. We were so skinny. It was like Artful Dodger needs to eat sometime, you know? Walter Martin. I remember going to meet this guy, Bob Krasnow. He was an old industry guy. We went to his apartment on the Upper East Side. The elevator opens and there's a handsome manservant there. He had these slippers on that had a cursive K on them, and he's just walking around the house. We're all completely hungover and Walter's there negotiating, our toothless spokesperson. Carl Swanson. The courting went on for 8 months, during which they continued to play shows. Jason Gordon. There was this theater called the West Beth in the West Village. It's the theater where they used to do Hedwig and the Angry Inch when that first started. I saw Jonathan Fire Eater play there. It was their first time headlining, and they played as if it was Madison Square Garden. Those songs, City That Never Sleeps, Give Me Daughters, it was again, totally cathedral. And there's this hypnotic singer who literally looked like he was performing in a trance, and you were just sucked in. They were so captivating live, and there was such tension on stage between the band members. Everyone in that room became a believer. You felt like you were watching a band on the verge. This was right before they got signed. Walter Dirkax. There was a guy with this offshoot indie label who offered to do an EP. That became Tremble Under Boom Lights. Daniel Kessler. I fell in love with that EP. It crushed me. I still listen to it all the time. It's still sometimes part of the Interpol playlist in between sets. Jamie Hintz. Tremble Under Boom Lights is still one of my favorite records to this day. I remember once before a show seeing the bass player sound-checking the bass. It was no bass sound like anyone was doing. It sounded like something Lee Scratch Perry would have been doing, just an absolutely toneless big sub-bass. He kept saying, "Turn the treble down more, turn the treble down more," until it was just nothing but bass, just lolling, light-headed, like a bruise. Carl Swanson. I remember Stuart telling me they couldn't sign to Sony because it was too much of a world power. Mark Spitz. You think you're the king of the world because you're the king of Ludlow Street.
Aaron Norris. The label negotiations went on throughout the spring of 96.
Stuart Lupton. It was really fun to watch Walter Dirkax argue with these seasoned executives from Geffen, because he was this toothless Brooklyn hard-ass.
Aaron Norris. I remember sitting with Seymour Stein and Sylvia Rhodes at Elektra Records, and Walter posed this question. Say we only want to sell 500,000 records, and we want to stop right there. We don't want to sell any more than that. What are you going to do? Seymour Stein looked around like, is this guy retarded?
Walter Martin. People from California thought Walter was one of those candid camera jokes. Stuart Lupton. We eventually signed with DreamWorks because they had George Michael, Cool Keith, Rufus Wainwright. Rufus was around during all this time. I loved hanging out with him. We would go out and people would say, "You guys are today's equivalent of Lennon and Dylan." And Rufus would say, "That's a little over the top, but thanks." We liked that. We'd go out to get our egos fed. Rufus Wainwright. Stuart was such a sweet, sweet kid. We really had a lovely time together. He was such a romantic figure, so beautiful and so wild, and really kind of deer in the headlights. We did a lot of drugs together, and we had a couple of moments where we'd just take off all of our clothes, but it wasn't sex. He just liked to expose himself, which I really appreciated.
Gideon Yeago.
Jonathan Fire Eater were these very sexy guys with this lush sound who were signing a million-dollar deal. Paul Maroon. Oh yes, the million-dollar deal. People just don't understand how these things work. Walter Martin. You get the million-dollar deal, but you don't get it all at once. It was a three-record deal, and the $1 million is the total for everything you're going to get. And you have to pay for your recording. If we had turned in another record, we would have gotten some more money. Paul Maroon. I got $800 a month from the band. Walter Martin. I think I got a check for $18,000 or something one time, which I could not believe. I didn't have a girlfriend at the time, so I just went on a trip to Europe by myself for 2 weeks. Stuart Lupton. Walter put his dental plan into our contract. Walter Martin. We were the second band in history, or at least this is what I've always claimed, to get dental insurance in their record deal. Walter used that deal to get his teeth fixed.
Jenny Eliscu. The general attitude very quickly became, oh, everyone is trying to sign them? Well then, fuck them.
Carl Swanson. There was a bit of a backlash. Walter Martin. We did a lot of touring, and nobody, outside of our hipster friends in New York, nobody would go see us play. Stuart Lupton. We were playing to empty rooms, man. We were playing to empty rooms. Still, we went to London like 8 times. Walter Dirkax. It was in England that people first started to write about the drugs. Walter Martin. It was sort of an uphill battle from that moment on. Stuart Lupton. Was it me versus them? Yeah, because I was on hard drugs and they weren't. Also, I loved them, but it was like, come on, we're in New York. We tricked our parents. This is how far you're willing to go? Let's throw down. It wasn't as simple as let's do hard drugs or not. They were less adventurous. Walter Dirkax. There are some people that have issues with drugs and you will never know it. And there are some people where their addiction can take them over. With Stu, it did get to that, to the point where it affected his ability to not only hide the fact that he was on drugs, but also to function.
Jenny Eliscu. I mean, there was a junkie at the helm. Aaron Norris. I remember there was a Tompkins Square Park show in the band shell, and he basically didn't show up. I think that was my fault, because we were both high as a motherfucker. It was like, oh, fuck, do we have a gig?
Walter Dirkax. Basically, at that point, the band had a lot of money behind them and a lot of pressure and a schedule to keep to. Stuart just didn't understand that now there were certain times where he needed to be on the straight and narrow. He just didn't get that. Daniel Kessler. Their record came out and it didn't do very well. They had some issues. Jason Gordon. I interviewed them after it came out and I was like, what's going on with this record, man? Where is the single? They're like, that's what the record company said.
Jenny Eliscu. It was over. People forgot they ever existed. Total implosion.
Stuart Lupton. The band played Central Park July 28, 1998, and we broke up that day. After that show, I went to Harmony Korine's. I went in his bathroom cabinet and took some pills. I figured they were Harmony's, so they had to be great. Walter Martin. I literally looked up a college in the Yellow Pages that day. Daniel Kessler. New York was ready. New York was in love. Stuart was the true rock and roll persona that people were craving. Jason Gordon. A bunch of us were just heartbroken. They were the band that could make it out of New York. They were going to bring the underground sound to the mainstream. Daniel Kessler. There was nothing parallel to that as far as hype. It wouldn't be like that again until the Strokes. Nick Valenci. It was always industry people who would mention, oh yeah, you guys are like what Jonathan Fire Eater should have been 5 years ago. And we were like, who the fuck is that? I'd never heard of him. Chapter 6. A bunch of little bands starting to creep up.
Justine D. Around the same time as Jonathan Fire Eater, there was another band who was actually really good, but also never went anywhere. The Mooney Suzuki. They were playing so much.
Matt Pinfield. People forget about those guys. Ryan Gentles. By 2000, the Mooney Suzuki were the fucking big shit on the scene. They were king shit of fuck mountain. Matt Pinfield. They were fun. They had a little MC5, but with a punk edge to it. They were a New York meets Detroit kind of thing. Anthony Rossomando. We played with the Moonies. I remember them being pretty cool dudes who were just up for it. Local kids with a little bit of dosh in their pocket. They could afford to have a good time. Nick Mark. I loved the way they looked. They were all in black shirts with bob haircuts. Anthony Rossomando. There were a bunch of little bands starting to creep up. Nobody really had the songs, but everyone had the look or the vibe or the drive to make something cool. Nick Valenci. I was the Mooney Suzuki's number one fan when I was 16. I went to the Luna Lounge and I saw the Mooney Suzuki, and that's when bells went off. I thought, these guys are so fucking together and they're so tight, they're so well rehearsed. This is a proper show. It's not just four slubs on stage, staring at their feet. I got so excited by the Mooney Suzuki, the very next show they did, I brought Julian, Fab, Nikolai. I brought all the guys who I played music with. I was like, check out this fucking band. Nikolai Fraicher. They had this thing. I remember seeing them once at CBGB's. I think it was Julian, Albert, and me. And we were kind of blown away. Sam was jumping on the bass drum. It was a total spectacle. John, who was the bassist at the time, had some guy who was tugging on his cord. He walked off the stage and punched the guy in the face. It was like, holy shit, this is what we want to do. Nick Valenci. At the Luna Lounge, there must have been 80 people at their show. That was a big deal. We couldn't even get a gig at the Luna Lounge at that point. Julian Casablancas. That was pretty much what we were aiming for. The Mooney Suzuki. Gideon Yego. You've got to understand the venues at the time. There used to be a place called the Academy up in Times Square, and it was a 1,000-person theater. That's where you'd go to see the Guided by Voices of the world. Then you had Tramps in the 20s, which is where you'd see the indie rock bands of the day. And then there were the Lower East Side and East Village clubs like Brownies, CBGB's, the Mercury Lounge, Luna Lounge, and I even put Maxwell's and Hoboken on there. That was a much smaller level. People who were playing to 150, 200 people maximum. You'd go there to see all these boutique kind of bands. Daniel Kessler. The two really good clubs to play were Brownies and the Mercury Lounge. A few years later, there were a plethora of venues that opened up, but at the beginning, there was a lot of competition to play those spots.
Karen O. It just seemed like such a smaller world. You couldn't just find out about things. We would just go walking around, putting up flyers, stapling them to lampposts, leaving them at bookstores and record stores. That's what people did.
Gideon Yego.
You'd go down to the bars to hear rock and roll and to drink. You'd go to get fucked up and meet people who were into the same shit that you were into. It wasn't like there was an expectation that you were going to blink and somebody who was playing a 200-person venue was going to suddenly have the world's biggest impact on fashion, photography, culture, and cool. That just wasn't why anyone was doing it. It didn't even seem possible. Dennis Callow. The spots were Don Hills, Brownies, Mercury Lounge was great, 2A was awesome, Sway was... The curtains were always closed. That place, Bar 13, that's where the shout parties were.
Zach Lippez. We would all go to shout.
Gideon Yeago.
The shout parties totally set the groundwork for all 2000s bands. It was where you would go on Sunday nights to dance and drink and listen. God knows how many STDs and drug addictions sprouted out of those parties. For a lot of kids that were already inclined to go digging in record shops and vintage clothing stores to find their gear, it was the equivalent with music. Suddenly you're looking into the Rascals and Easy Beats and very early Rolling Stones. It was like finding a good motorcycle jacket for the first time. It was like looking at Steve McQueen and saying, like, fuck yeah, I want in on that.
Karen O. Just prior to getting on stage with Yeah Yeah Yeahs at the Mercury Lounge, where I kind of unleashed Karen O for the first time or whatever, I was going to shout. My best friend and I would get there early, have like 7 Cosmopolitans, and be doing knee slides on the dance floor. The dance floor at Bar 13 became where I practiced this persona.
Gideon Yeago.
Now that you had a bunch of people who would put 2 and 2 together, I can play in a rock band and that band could sound like something that would play at Shout, there was this immediate audience because you could get all the Shout kids at your shows. I mean, you could fill 100-person and 150, 200-person venues with spillover from kids who would go to that party. Everything that followed, the explosion of all those 2000s bands, came out of a combination of Giuliani, the dot-com money, and the concentration of wealth that kind of pushed into downtown, and then the Shout parties. Sammy James Jr. One night at Shout, we got there, and everybody was freaking out because I had the NME, and they had reviewed one of our singles. We were like, I don't know what the fuck NME is, but it was just like a British magazine? Isn't that great?
Gideon Yeago.
Also, that whole garage band thing was taking place at the time. It wasn't just New York. It was Seattle, Detroit, Chicago, Ohio, all over the country. Vito Roccoforte. Back in, like, 2000, before we moved to New York, Detroit was one of those cities where there was a few cool bands around. There was this band, The Go, that was on Sub Pop.
Jenny Eliscu. Yeah, Jack White was in The Go.
Luke Jenner. They were signed to Sub Pop, and we were signed to Sub Pop, and we couldn't get Sub Pop to pay attention to us because they were too focused on The Go.
Jenny Eliscu. This is all before the White Stripes. By the time The Go's record came out on Sub Pop, Jack was no longer in the band. But I remember seeing this old press photo. The publicist sent it to me. I remember looking at the computer screen as it slowly loaded the photo, and I'm like, who is that giant homunculus in the middle with the curly-haired, skinny, puppy, fucking leather vibe? He was so incongruous with the rest of the band. And that was Jack White.
Dean Wareham. Later, the White Stripes would popularize it. But I felt like in every city, all over the world, there are bands exactly like that making garage music.
Jenny Eliscu. There's a Detroit-New York parallel in both eras, right? I mean, how fucking weird is it that 30 years after it was argued whether the Stooges were inventing punk in Detroit or the Ramones in New York, let's leave the UK out of it for a minute, that you had Jack White in Detroit and the Strokes in New York?
Chapter 7. Ain't nobody here for bottle service. James Murphy. New York was fucking horrible, and I thought that was the most exciting thing in the world. It was like being in the suburbs. There was nothing there, so anything was possible.
Justine D. James used to come to my party at Life. I met him there. And he also used to come and hear me DJ at Sway all the time on Mondays. It all happened at once. I started DJing. I had a Monday night residency at Sway, Rock and Roll Mondays. I worked at Spa, I worked at Tiswas, and then Motherfucker started. It all happened kind of within a year.
James Murphy. I would go to Spa when Justine was DJing.
Justine D. I'd been a record collector since I was a teenager, and then I just became immersed in the downtown mod scene, which was really two parties, Shout on Sundays and Tiswas at Coney Island High on Thursday nights. For 2 or 3 years straight, I was going out 5 nights a week just having fun being a young person in New York.
Mark spits. Don't forget Squeeze Box at Don Hills. Tiz Was, Motherfucker, and later Misshapes, these all flow from the river of Squeeze Box. It preceded everything. It was hosted by Mistress Formica, who dressed in drag and wore tons of makeup and gave serious attitude. Rob Sheffield. Mistress Formica was presiding over the scene at that super scuzzy club. It smelled like mildew, and that's when people could still smoke there. It was glorious. There was no dress code and no posing. It was just dance, drink, get up, do your thing, listen to music.
Justine D. They had the most crazy video up on the TV screens. It was like gay porn custom spliced with 70s cereal commercials. It was so disturbing.
Rob Sheffield. The first time I went, the DJ was so good that I made a tape of all the songs he played that night so I could simulate the experience. From AC/DC's Touch Too Much to Dusty Springfield's Haunted to Led Zeppelin's Misty Mountain Hop to the Donna's You Make Me Hot. Mark Spitz. Everyone who was anyone on the downtown scene was there. Gay, straight, rock stars and celebrities. Courtney Love and Joey Ramone and Debbie Harry and Drew Barrymore. Thomas Honorato. Squeeze Box. I went to all of those. Courtney Love would get up on stage and Drew Barrymore would be dancing on the bar.
Justine D. I first met Thomas there, actually. He is the quintessential seasoned New York doorman.
Mark Spitz. Everyone had to know Thomas. If he liked you, you were in. But he wasn't nasty like a Studio 54 doorman.
Justine D. He was very mean to me at the door, almost made me cry. Very cunty.
Thomas Honorato. I was mean a lot, but also you never truly got my mean side unless you acted like an asshole. But Don Hill, he had ushered in that wave, the whole gay rock thing with Squeeze Box, and then he ushered in Nick and Justine with Tiz Was. Nick Mark. We moved Tiz Was to Don Hills in maybe 1998, and that's when we brought Justine in. It just seemed like an obvious thing to do. She had great taste in music, she looked fantastic, everybody loved her, and she's not a fuck-up in any way. Rob Sheffield. Jenny Eliskew has some stories about the bathroom line at Don Hills.
Jenny Eliskew. I used to have such a good streak of making out in the line for the bathroom at Tiz Was. It was kind of crazy. But then they moved them. The men and the women were far away from each other, so you couldn't have a heterosexual bathroom line make out anymore. That's when things took a turn.
Thomas Honorato. Tiz Was mattered to me because I was an Anglophile, whether it was David Bowie or whether it was Blur and Oasis, and that was the music that was played there. Jason Gordon. That was the thing with Tiz Was. All of a sudden, here's a nightclub that plays Britpop that you love, and they are dropping a Jonathan Fire Eater song, and then they also play like The Rapture's House of Jealous Lovers and a Strokes song, and a White Stripes song.
Justine D. Tiz Was also booked every band just by default of being a local band.
Sean Christensen. You really couldn't find success in that time unless you were part of that club circuit. All of the bands we're talking about played Tiz Was at one point in time or another. Thomas Honorato. I saw the Strokes play Tiz Was at Don Hills with 100 other people.
Justine D. There was a rumor that either the first or second show the Strokes played there, one of the guys had sex with a girl down in the Don Hills basement, and someone snapped a photo of whichever guy's butt it was.
Nick Mark. There was a curtain under the stage at Don Hills. Girl Harbor, which was the band that played before the Strokes that night, went behind the curtain after both bands had finished, and there's a certain Stroke shagging a girl on the drum riser. They took a photograph of his spotty ass and used it as their next flyer.
April Long. I have that flyer, the one with Nick's butt.
Rob Sheffield. Justine did Tiz Was and this other party motherfucker. Motherfucker was just on holidays. It was for special occasions. Thomas Honorato. Motherfucker was really Michael T's party in the end.
Justine D. Michael T., who's very sassy. I'm sure you know, brought us all together and said, I have an idea for a holiday weekend only rock and roll extravaganza, and I want it to be a mixed bag of people. I want it to be drag queens standing next to mods, standing next to normal people, standing next to ex-club kids. 400 people came to the first one. It just happened very naturally, and we had tapped into something. I think because the city was in a state of Giuliani oppression.
Rob Sheffield. You have to remember, the very idea of dancing to rock music was mind-blowing. Tiz Was and Motherfucker were fantastic in terms of saying rock and roll is something to dance to. You don't need 20 minutes of German Balearic trance twiddle-step remix in order to justify dancing to something. You could just dance to the Kinks or Supergrass.
Jenny Eliskew. Motherfucker only happened on these three-day weekends, and they had it in a few different places. One, I remember, on the far west side, one in Chelsea, but it was always three floors, and it was dark and brick and metal. And you weren't sure where you were, just wandering around a crowded stairway until you're in the disco. It was very gay-friendly, which was fucking awesome, and also contributed to the festive atmosphere. But the fact that it was three-day weekends, everyone was, especially at that age, just pretty fucked up.
Rob Sheffield. It was at all of these horrible midtown clubs that you hated to go to. You'd go there, and the bouncers would give you a look, and you'd think, ain't nobody here for bottle service. Everybody's here to get super fucking high and sing Warm Leatherette.
Justine D. It was a really great time in New York because it was still pretty gritty, and we did it in the meatpacking district when it was meatpackers and black tranny hookers and people having full-on sex on the dance floor. It was crazy. It was great. With Motherfucker, we were able to provide a safe haven for people with a very alternative lifestyle. We always thought that the misfits were the stars.
Chapter 8. Dance music will save us all? Dave Gottlieb. Obviously, when grunge happened, alternative became a big deal. Then, when Kurt killed himself, the whole paradigm shifted because the only band that can wave the flag is Pearl Jam, and they recoiled from that. They get in a fight with Ticketmaster, which prevented them from being on the road. They stopped making videos. So, what is alternative at that point? Now REM is a pop band and U2 are playing arenas and stadiums. James Haubacker. We went from rock music, which was the greatest thing ever, to Lenny Kravitz. Dave Gottlieb. You have the Beastie Boys doing their thing, but they're leading another world. Sonic Youth is looked at as the band that swung and missed. Teenage Fan Club missed. The Traveling Circus of Lollapalooza collapsed. You have Oasis and Blur, but they're not ours. In the post-Nirvana days, it's aimless out there.
Gideon Yeago.
When I started at MTV in 1999, I was still in college. There was this running joke about me in the morning meetings pitching a Guided by Voices story. This is during the era of Britney Spears and NSYNC. Really what was selling was pop music. Britney Spears was selling 2 million records in a given week. Mark Spitz. The biggest band in the world was probably Korn or Limp Bizkit. Papa Roach was on the cover of Spin. P.O.D. was on the cover of Spin. It was the height of nu metal, and the biggest star in the world was Eminem. I mean, he was on the cover of Spin 3 times in 2000. Everyone was waiting for the next thing, and the next thing was supposed to be dance music. Tim Goldsworthy. Around 88, we had a big revolution in the UK. Dominique Keegan, The Summer of Love. Tim Goldsworthy. In 87, I was wearing all black, trying to look like I was in the Velvet Underground. And then it was suddenly about ecstasy. Shaved head, all of us out in the field, dancing. Simon Reynolds. It was initially based around imported music from America, Chicago, Detroit, and New York house music, and techno. But very quickly, people started making very homegrown British music. And in England, the vibe was determined by ecstasy. So there was a lot of breaking down of gender barriers, sexual barriers, racial barriers, a lot of idealism. People would go along to these parties and raves, not expecting it to have such a strong impact on their life, but it wasn't anything like the typical clubbing. Clubbing in the 80s had been sort of cool-oriented, cold and posy, and this was people losing it in a mass way, a collective high, dancing all night. Especially the events that were illegal and unlicensed in barns or warehouses, those events had a tremendous electric atmosphere of anarchy. So people embraced that idea of clubbing all weekend without sleep, having that high and then crashing. You couldn't wait until the next week. You got locked into this lifestyle of raving. After you had that experience, it was quite hard to go back to seeing a band on stage. Tim Goldsworthy. Electronica, horrible thing, but that's what I'm going to call it, was starting to take in Britain. You were seeing people like my first band, Uncle, going from selling a few 12 inches to suddenly selling a lot and touring and doing festivals and becoming proper bands. Simon Reynolds. It was about beat and sound culture in Britain. Massive Attack was one of the main Bristol groups, and their whole strategy was they were like record nerds. They took these obscure soul, jazz records, and some post-punk ones as well, and they would take the best bits of them and create new music out of their record collection. That was the big thing. That is where Tim Goldsworthy comes from, the beat scholar and sample scholar. It was a generation of smoking weed, taking other drugs, and being very sensitized to all of sound, the textures of sound, sound that could create intense pleasure and pictures in your mind. A psychedelic dance culture. James Haubacker. I had a club over in the meatpacking district called Plush that I opened in 95. It was a dance club. At that point, pretty much everyone's attitude was rock and roll was dead, and it was all dance music. Moby. I remember going to Under Acme to see a friend's band. It was some indie rock band. And there were all these people standing around holding rolling rocks, wearing flannel shirts, not talking to each other, and not dancing. I was like, this is awful. Then I went later that night to the Limelight, and it was like 1,500 people on ecstasy, jumping up and down, dancing like crazy, and I was like, clearly this is where I need to be. Jonathan Galkin. This was the era of Twilo, Limelight. I wasn't into the drugs that people were doing there. I liked drugs, but that scene, I'm not going into a K-hole. It had a sinister vibe, like, this doesn't seem nice, I'm not going to make a lot of new friends here tonight. And also, lots of people would slap me for saying this, it didn't seem like it was about the music. It was supposed to be about fun. But then, they murdered someone. Mark Spitz. Michael Alig was convicted of manslaughter around 97. Jonathan Galkin. That's not how the party's supposed to end. James Haubacker. The drugs always influenced the music. The ecstasy got really good, it got really designer. And then I think at a certain point there was a lot of strychnine in the ecstasy, and we all stopped doing it because it was like you'd wake up and all your joints were aching. But there was a period where that was the drug of choice, and I think that had an influence on things musically. Mark Spitz. In the late 90s, there was very much a post-rave thing still happening. It was Daft Punk, Chemical Brothers, Prodigy, and Moby. He had a real connection at Spin because he was like the Egghead's connection to hedonism. Simon Reynolds. The Prodigy became MTV stars. Alan Light. Spin did a Prodigy cover before I got there. On the one hand, it was, okay, there's an interesting thing happening here. And on the other hand, it was, God, this is being forced down our throats as a phenomenon. Mark Spitz. I sort of, like, looked down a little bit on the raver people as maybe a little deluded. The way that you would maybe look down at someone who is into the secret. When Oprah said, "Here's the secret. Here's how you're going to get your brand new Volvo hatchback," I was just like, I'm not sure this is a revolution. Moby. There was a lot of reason to believe that rock and roll and any sort of leather jacket New York Dolls sense was not coming back. Ever. Chapter 9. That was really the birth of DFA. Simon Reynolds. New York seemed very romantic. Tim Goldsworthy. When we first came, we were going to these loft parties in Williamsburg, and I was expecting the new Liquid Liquid or the new Jungle Brothers or the new performance art new wave, no wave, someone slashing themselves or shitting on other people. But no! There were really lame drum and bass clubs where people were reading poetry and playing bongos. Then there were the Centroflies and Limelights, which were just nasty, not fun. We got over there expecting to be like, we're coming home to the birthplace of all the records that we loved. From the Velvet Underground to Silver Apples to Television to Public Enemy. Like every single part of my record collection that is important, this is where it happened. This is the birthplace. But instead, we get there and it's just shooby-doo-doop-doop-doop-house. We were like, what the fuck is going on? Dominique Keegan. Marcus and myself used to throw parties. There was a lot of money around, and the East Village was very quickly becoming gentrified, but bars were still cheap. Marcus Lamkin. Dom always had ideas about starting a label. Dominique Keegan. I was more, let's fucking go, let's do some shit. Marcus was like, I don't want to open a bar, I don't want to throw parties. And I was like, shut up, we're doing it. Perfect combination. Luke Jenner. When I first met him, James Murphy didn't like two things. He didn't like Bob Dylan, and he didn't like disco. James Murphy. I was in a band called Pony. Brian Long. Pony was good, man. James Murphy. And I was in a band called Speed King. Nobody gave a fuck about me. Tyler Brody. I met James at Brownies. He was playing pinball. He was playing in bands, but mostly recording every other band that was around at the time. Dominique Keegan. James was this super rock and roll looking kid with this long chain through the wallet. Tyler Brody. He would grow his hair out and sell it for wigs. He had really lustrous long hair. Dominique Keegan. I remember being obsessed with how straight his hair was. James Murphy. People grew up in scenes, but I didn't have one. I was alone in my town. I was by myself. There was no guidance, no critical mass, but there was incredible unguided access to stuff. I had one of the best record stores in the country within 15 minutes of my house, and that's where every dollar I had went. Jonathan Galkin. I had the older brother getting me into 4AD records. James had Princeton Record Exchange. James Murphy. I remember buying the birthday party record because of the cover. I was not cool. What I was an obsessive audio nerd. It made me no money, got me no points. That was part of my definition. I wasn't going anywhere. I wanted to, but I wasn't. And oh God, I was aggressive. Juan McLean. I was going to school at Providence College, but I didn't graduate because I started my first band, Six Finger Satellite. It was a very post-punk influenced band with a disco rhythm section, angular guitars, and scary synth noises. Simon Reynolds. They were the very first group I came across who started referencing the post-punk era again. I did a piece on them in 96 or something. And they were going on about Chrome and about, I don't know, Pill and the Strangers. There was no one doing that at that time. Juan McLean. James became Six Finger Satellite's live sound engineer. James Murphy. Juan and I met in 90, and we did not like each other. But after I started going on tour with them, we became sound nerd buddies. Juan McLean. Around 1994, we spent a lot of time on tour sitting in a van. Just James and I, driving everyone crazy incessantly talking about recording. We were just obsessed with it.
At some point, he had become a fifth member of the band because he was doing so much with the live sound. Then he helped produce our last album. Shortly after that was when I quit the band. I just felt very uninspired. Indie rock in general, which was what it was starting to be called, it had gone in a direction that I really hated. Tyler Brody. I was bored of rock. I assumed we were going to move on as a culture. And that was the problem with all the bands in the 90s. They were all just guitar, bass, and drums. Just boring. There's only so much you can do with that. Warren Fisher. Take Elliot Smith. You couldn't get more serious. The singer-songwriter guy pouring his heart out. And I'm not trying to take away from Elliot Smith, because I really respect him. But that is so encoded. Like, how you present that, what kind of photography is associated with that, what kind of song titles you're limited to. There's a history of it that's encrusted with decades of other people doing it. Nick Drake, Bob Dylan. And you can keep going. It's very hard to crack through all this fucking legacy of the genre. It was like, oh, so actually that's the most plastic thing that you could ever do. Tyler Brody. James had the only studio that I knew of. It was called Plantain. He liked the name because it was the lesser of the fruits. James Murphy. Plantain was my old studio in Brooklyn. The guy who lent us a couple of $1,000 for the studio said he invested in Plantains. Tyler Brody. I'm from North Carolina, and I went to film school at NYU. I started doing music stuff the summer in between freshman and sophomore year. My friend and I bought a bunch of gear, but didn't have a studio. I wanted to start a record label, but James was always hesitant. I knew he could record sound much better than I could, so I figured he'd be a much better person to run a recording studio. Of all the people in the music scene that I met over those years, he was the most impressive. I wanted to see what he could do. Jonathan Galkin. Tyler is a patron of the arts. Tyler Brody. I had all this gear, so I basically said to James, I'll let you use it if I can use your studio occasionally. He had this place in Dumbo. Now it's probably very expensive, but at the time it was super sketchy. You couldn't leave anything in your car, or it would just be gone. Maybe 6 months later, the landlords decided to kick everyone out of this studio. And around the same time, I bought a building in the West Village, so we just moved it all there. A freshman year at NYU, I lived in a dorm. I was ready to get out, and I just inherited money, so why not just buy something? I proposed that to my father, who had a lot more money, and we decided we would buy something together. He bought the Plantain building with the intention of giving it to me. Marcus Lamkin. The big opportunity came through Dom's girlfriend. She knew this guy Tyler Brody. Tyler approached Dominique. Dominique Keegan. I met James through Tyler. I was dating an English girl called Charlotte who knew Tyler because he was in NYU film school with Jonathan Galkin and Darren Aronofsky and all these fucking assholes that we just used to rip the piss out of. Tyler Brody. First, I decided to renovate. I had a Labrador and I had a roof, and the only way to get up to the roof was a ladder, so I kind of wanted to build stairs to the roof for my dog Jackson, so I had an architect in for that. He hung out up there a lot. He lived at the studio. Also, we were right next to Integral Yoga, and we got all these noise complaints, so it also seemed like a good time to soundproof. The architecture just kept growing. I'd started the company, but I was still in college, so I interned for myself for credit at school. James would write my reports because he was the only other person officially at the company. I did very well. Marcus Lamkin. Tyler was giving James a studio space, and it was eventually going to be a label. Tim Goldsworthy. James had done sound for BS 2000. Marcus Lamkin. Adam from the Beastie Boys had another band, BS 2000, with the guy from Suicidal Tendencies. Tim Goldsworthy. So he'd been hanging out with Adam Hurwitz on tour in Japan. Marcus Lamkin. Adam and James were buddies. James Murphy. We play basketball 2 or 3 times a week at PS41. I'd go hungover. We'd be covering each other, just sweating drugs. Marcus Lamkin. Tyler wanted a recording studio, a movie production house, and a record label. That was the original idea. He asked Dominique to start a record label, and Dom said, I only want to do it if I can do it with this guy Marcus. I said, sure, great, sounds awesome. Tyler Brody. We had Plantain Films and Plantain Records. Originally, this was with my friend Jonah Smith from school. But Jonah and James were just... I remember some lunch somewhere where it seemed obvious that it wasn't going to work with them. So I figured I would just keep them separate. I introduced Dominique and Marcus to James on the day, that great day, that Dr. Octagonicologist by Cool Keith came out. Jaleel Bunton. We were obsessed with that album, too. Tyler Brody. Dominique and Marcus were making a track for Plant, and James was around the corner in the East Village. I was like, I should put these guys together. That also didn't go so well. I mean, they got along, but we kept the two labels separate. James had his recording studio, and then there was Dom and Marcus doing Plant. I say a lot that James had to be separated from people. Yeah, well, it was true in a lot of cases. When the Plant building was still under construction, James made the architect, Domitila Enders, cry. Dominique Keegan. I would never say James is my favorite person. I would say James is a complete cunt. I have a huge amount of respect for him and a huge amount of love for him, but he's a cunt. And his best friends would call him that. James Murphy. It's part of the deal. I'm obsessive compulsive. It's part of the parlance. We can laugh, but it's what I'm gonna do. I found a cassette recently of my band practice from 1983, 8th grade, and I realized what a nightmare I must have been. We're playing, and the song is wrong, and I hear me stop, and I hear me trying to be laid back and say, oh, that's wrong, maybe we can play it right. I'm 13 years old, and I'm already like, this is not the way I want to play this song. We're just having fun. No, we're not. We're not just having fun. We have to do this right. That was already there. Dominique Keegan. James was going to be Tyler's indie guy, and we were going to be the dance label. I love Tyler to death, but he's not a super hungry go-getter kid to make it happen. He would collect these people and kind of set them up and could afford to do that properly. Marcus Lamkin. When Tyler got the building finished and it was time for people to move in, he basically offered me a job there. He said, why don't you come and give up the day job and come and run the record label from the building? James was putting his studio in the basement at the same time. You could say Tyler is the classic trustafarian guy. But also, he didn't just waste it away, you know? He was giving a lot of people careers and lives. He did want to do something creative. He wanted to do something really cool and bring together a lot of cool people under one roof and try to make something awesome. Dominique was at work at the record label, and in my time off between cabinet making, which is what I did for work, I'd go down into the basement and work on a record. Darren Aronofsky was in the other room editing Pi. Tyler Brody. Darren went to AFI, and I met him at Sundance the year he had shot his film but didn't have enough money to edit it. So he was at my house editing. Marcus Lamkin. James was around being James. Dominique Keegan. When I first met James, I didn't realize what a fucking visionary and genius he was. He'd say things and I'd be like, whatever, what do you fucking know? But in hindsight, that motherfucker knew what he was talking about. Marcus Lamkin. James hated dance music at the time and thought it was all CNC Music Factory and the stuff on MTV. And I was like, you and your punk rock. I started playing him good dance music, but every time I was like, dude, check this out, this is the best record ever, he would say, that's just a can sample or liquid liquid. Every single time I would play him a record, he would play me the original track that it sampled. So it was this great education for me and for him. We hit it off. He really liked the sort of dance music I was playing him, and I was getting schooled. All my heroes, I was just like, they just sampled all this stuff? James Murphy. When I was a dummy, I was the rock and roll dummy. Marcus was like, this is Uncle, and I was like, no, that's Liquid Liquid. That's Suicide. That's Silver Apples. That's Can. I'd play it for him. After that, we got along. He was like, okay, you know the records that the guys I like are culling from to make their records. I'm drinking from the same well of this stuff, but I don't know anything about it. Dominique Keegan. One of the most important things I remember James saying to me and Marcus was to hit things when you are in the studio. Just pick things up and hit them. Just hit things and make sound. That's a pretty good place to start, actually. Tim Goldsworthy. I came over to New York in 99, February the 13th. I remember thinking, this is the safest place I've ever been to in my life. James Murphy. Tim thought he'd get here and there'd be people breakdancing on street corners. And he got here and there was a bunch of strollers and it was boring. Tim Goldsworthy. We got up early on the first morning because of jet lag. We went out and it's, ah, there's steam coming out of the streets. We thought, this is nuts, this is New York. We went up to somebody's house to ask for directions, hoping they were going to pull a gun on us. And instead they're like, oh, you're not from here? You should check out this place and that place. Everybody was really nice. It was really disappointing. Simon Reynolds. The idea of whether or not dance music was truly embraced in America is complicated. Dominique Keegan. What people expected to happen didn't really happen. Dance music didn't take in America the way it had in the UK. But at the same time, that scene created the first wave of indie kids who really got into dance music, like Luke from The Rapture, and James, who was a punk rocker. Jonathan Galkin. I had a context for dance music, well before DFA. Andy, my older brother, was bringing home lots of stuff from Wax Trax when house music was active and acid house compilations started getting into the import bins. Dance music came out of the import bin, and the import bin was the cool club. Tim Goldsworthy. American indie music had completely lost its sexiness. It was all that sorry I have a penis kind of indie rock, which James was part of. James Murphy. Tim was cool, I was not. Simon Reynolds. Tim was the archetypal British engineer guy. He had very delicate hands, him being a bit of a watchmaker. That's a British archetype for the guy who owns a lot of records and knows all about music making. Marcus Lamkin. I was psyched, you know? I was like, Tim Goldsworthy is coming over? Tim Goldsworthy. He's this guy, he makes all my favorite records. And I would always be playing James, that Mo Wax stuff. James Murphy. Nobody cared about Tim here, but Marcus was a huge fan. Dominique Keegan. He was really Marcus's idol. We used to call him Goldfinger, the guy with the Midas touch. Tim Goldfinger, because he was very good. Tim was the original guy with James Lavelle and Uncle, terribly famous guy. Simon Reynolds. James Lavelle was one of these guys who was a nerd, but managed to turn it into cool. I think of him as a breakbeat version of Quentin Tarantino. A guy who built a whole aesthetic around nerd knowledge. The kind of guy who has a huge collection of Star Wars memorabilia and vintage sneakers. The Mo Wax records were very stylized and well-packaged. James Murphy. When I met Tim, I didn't like him. He was really cocky and English and aloof. Tim Goldsworthy. I came to New York with David Holmes, who I think is a forgotten link in all this. Without David, a lot of this would never have happened. James Murphy. There's pre-Tim and pre-Holmes, and then there's post-Tim and post-Holmes. Pre-David Holmes, it was no fun. He ignited something. Dominique Keegan. David Holmes is the biggest prick I've ever met in my life. Tim Goldsworthy. Well, Dom used to really annoy people. Dominique Keegan. I actually dislike David so much that it's kind of pushed through to the other side. He's a remarkably smart and talented individual. He just didn't like me from the beginning. There was a personality clash. David Holmes. Dominique? I mean, I just know him to say hello to. I don't remember us hanging out.